In the second part of the program, we feature the perspectives of Dr. Leora Horn, who visited the practice of Dr. Yanjun Ma. I met with both of these physicians to review the patients that were seen. And to begin, Dr. Ma presented a woman in her mid-70s with metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung.
This is a nice lady. At the time when I first met her, she was about 76 years old, and she had stage 4 poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma at the time of diagnosis. At the time, she did have multi-organ involvement, lung, liver, adrenal glands, and a lot of bone mets. So she had PD-L1 expression 70% with adenohistology. So she had a first-line pembrolizumab single-agent treatment and had a pretty good response. And she did have a little up and down. We'll have a couple nodes progress here and there, but overall, pretty smooth course. The major thing and the hurdle in her treatment is in the middle of her treatment, she developed severe right thigh pain. It looks like there was a large bone met in the right femur. So at the time, you know, we offered palliative radiation for pain palliation. And so she got a little better, but the pain recurred and got worse. And we talked to radiation oncologists, they look at the image, they felt like they can offer a little more. She had a second course. And then the pain just never got better. It continued to worsen. Eventually, she had a pathological fracture in that leg and had an ER visit and admitted to the hospital. At the time, the on-call orthopedic surgeon went ahead, did a percutaneous procedure, and fixed the femur. If I was notified, I would have preferred to get some tissue, had an open procedure. But when I saw her, it's already done. So when she came back, the procedure fixed her leg. She's able to limp on that leg, but the pain did not improve at all. So at this point, her overall disease is very stable. The major concern from my standpoint is, does she have residual disease in that leg? Because she's approaching about 2 years on single-agent pembrolizumab, and I would be uncomfortable to stop her immune therapy if there is a potential borderline control disease in that leg, or is all her pain just from radiation necrosis or mal-healed fracture? So to me, this leg is becoming her major morbidity, and what is the best approach to address that leg pain is her major issue right now.
So before we get into that, Leora, I want to just backtrack a little bit to the original decision for her original treatment, because she was a patient who was presenting with a high PD-L1 level. And that brings up the question of how generally these patients would be managed, particularly whether or not they're going to get chemotherapy. Just kind of curious in general where you are today with that question, Leora, and how this patient, looking back at her initial presentation, would fit into your model.
So, you know, I think you have two options in this cohort of patients with high PD-L1 score. Are you going to do pembrolizumab alone with the KEYNOTE-024 data, or are you going to do carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab? My bias is in a patient who you think would tolerate single-agent pembrolizumab. So even though she had a high burden of disease, she was not particularly symptomatic. I would favor doing pembrolizumab alone. It's very rare where a patient has a large lung mass or they have significant liver metastases and I want to get a quicker response. So I'll use carbo, pemetrexed, pembrolizumab. And that's based on KEYNOTE-021G, suggesting the time to treatment response is 1.2 months rather than around 2.2 months with pembro alone. But I would have given this patient pembrolizumab alone, and that still is my preferred option for mutation-negative patients with a PD-L1 score of over 50%.
And just to kind of understand, because now she's been on therapy for 2 years, Yan, where did she have the disease when she started, and what happened? What's the situation? Did she actually respond?
She did have a response. At the beginning, she had cervical spine, right femur, bilateral jugular, lymph nodes, lung, liver, left adrenal glands, and a possible portal vein tumor thrombosis. Those are the sites of disease she had. And at this point, typical for immune therapy patients, she will have up and downs. A couple nodes will get a little bigger. And sometimes we just waited. Next scan will get better. We have radiated a couple nodes when they keep getting bigger. I wouldn't know if she continues therapy, those nodes will settle down or not. So we offer a little bit of local radiation here and there. But overall, she has responded. The disease are much smaller in size. I think we had a couple PET scans in between. These are mostly PET negative, but some of these have a little bit PET activity. So the right femur, of course, had two cores of radiation, had a fracture. That is, still has some SUV uptake in the right femur. From a scan standpoint, I cannot say for sure she has residual disease or this is just all from a radiation toxicity.
So I'm curious, Leora, how did she appear to you today? Was she with anyone today? And how uncomfortable did she appear to you? What did she tell you about her quality of life, Leora?
She's a little bit frail, but she looks okay. I think her quality of life is diminished by her hip pain. She can't drive because she can't lift that leg up well. She can't get comfortable. She's got a significant amount of lymphedema in that leg, which has improved with some therapy. But her quality of life really seems to be determined not by her therapy and not by the disease anywhere else besides what's going on in that right hip, which we don't even know if it's even cancer.
I'm curious, Leora, have you ever seen radiation necrosis? Have you ever seen a case like this?
So not the hip, but what we are seeing, and we've seen this a few times now over the last few years in patients who get things like concurrent chemo radiation for their lung cancer, these patients are now living a long time. And I've seen several patients with pathologic fractures in their thoracic vertebrae, which was right in the field of where they had their radiation previously. And so for this patient, hard to know if it's radiation necrosis. And unfortunately, as Yan mentioned, the patient did not get a tumor biopsy when the surgeon went in to repair their hip. And so I think it's important, and we even talked to the patient again today about, is it worth going to get a second opinion from an orthopedic oncologist to see if there's utility for going in and potentially repairing this in such a manner that this hip pain goes away and you can get information of, is there cancer present there or is there not? Because patients can live, we talked about that she could live for years with no evidence of cancer, but very limited quality of life. She was joking about going shopping without her husband, but she can't get to the shops without him, so that's not going to happen. And so can we impact her quality of life by figuring out how to repair this hip properly?
Yeah, and you said she had a percutaneous procedure. What exactly did they do?
Well, there's a small incision through the skin and that the rod was inserted into the femur and through the skin. And so it wasn't an open procedure. So there wasn't a biopsy done. And I think the visit today is helpful for her because we've been talking about this a little bit back and forth. She, you know, any patient, she's afraid of a real surgery. You know, she felt like she can avoid it. But we, coming from a different oncologist, has a similar recommendation. I think she's more convinced today. She will at least go in and get a consultation and look into it.
Has she had any toxicity, autoimmune problems at all?
She had two interesting possible autoimmune. She had a little thyroid dysfunction. Her lipase is very interesting. Her lipase will go very high without a clinical pancreatitis picture. When I usually would just treat through it, but for her, her lipase went to close to 900 at one point. We held her immune therapy for a month or so. It came down by itself, but she was never symptomatic, no nausea, vomiting, pain, or anything. We resumed treatment. It seemed to be fine. It has not flared up, so I'm not 100% sure that's related or not, but those are only two things she had so far, yeah.
I'm trying to remember, Leora, I've ever heard of autoimmune pancreatitis. Has that been seen?
It has been seen. There are patients who are symptomatic and asymptomatic, and for the patients who are asymptomatic, they've actually taken out the recommendations to hold therapy. So if you just see an isolated amylase or lipase elevation and the patients don't have symptoms, you don't necessarily have to hold the therapy. We've seen some patients with florid autoimmune pancreatitis, and they subsequently develop. I have a patient now who has type 1 diabetes as a result. You can't see it. It's just not very, sort of in that less than 1% group of patients.
That's interesting. Does this woman have any glucose intolerance?
No. Her glucose level has always been fine. Seems just to be the lipase we can see.
I have heard about diabetes with checkpoint inhibitors. Do you see elevated pancreatic enzymes?
Some of those two patients that I've had who have developed type 1 diabetes had changes in their amylase and lipase, and they all described symptoms of pancreatitis, like the bloating and fullness before they presented with their blood sugars in the 600s.
Wow, really interesting. And what about her thyroid dysfunction? What happened there?
I put her on a small dose of thyroid hormone replacement, but it wasn't very significant. It wasn't clinically significant. There were no symptoms from it. It was just a laboratory issue. So far, it has not. I think she was on, I can't remember the exact dose, 25 micrograms or a little bit of thyroid hormone replacement.
Another issue brought up by this case, Leora, is duration of checkpoint therapy. She's now been on for 2 years. Hopefully this problem in her hip is not even tumor related. What about the issue of stopping checkpoint therapy at some point in lung cancer? Where are we today with that? Where are you today?
I think it often becomes practice specific. When I talk to Eddie Guerin, he says he keeps going. I actually start preparing my patients when they hit around 18 months, that if we continue to see the response and you're still doing well when we get to 2 years, that we're going to stop your therapy.
Let's go on to the second case, your patient two. Maybe you can talk a little bit about his history.
So this is a slightly complicated case, a younger gentleman, 53. So when he presented, it was in the inpatient setting. At the time, he had extensive disease, and he had extensive mediastinal nodes, bowel cervical nodes, major parts of the liver was filled with metastases. He was almost going to frank hepatic failure. At the time, LFTs were sky high. So when he got diagnosed, he had a biopsy. The biopsy material was very limited. The histology initially was reported as a non-small cell carcinoma, favor adeno, but it was not based on a lot of stains because the tissue was limited. And the time, because how quickly he was deteriorating, how quickly the liver function was changing, so we decided to rush into chemotherapy. So because the clinical presentation, I chose a histology, a non-specific regimen. So we chose carboplatin and the nab-paclitaxel at the beginning instead of giving him carbo-pemetrexed. So he did have a very good, dramatic, quick response. And he quickly recovered to performance status close to zero within about 2 cycles of treatment. And then, of course, patients are very happy, the tolerance great. So later on, as more histology trickle in, we did have all the EGFR, BRAF, ALK, all those mutation studies, they all were negative.
Did he have a liquid biopsy? Did he have a plasma assay?
No, he had a nodal biopsy. It was a tissue biopsy.
Just kind of curious, we're talking about wild-type disease, Leora, but where does liquid biopsy fit in? Do you have patients like this sometimes where it's difficult to get adequate tissue? And how do you approach interpretation of liquid biopsies in this kind of situation?
I think it's reasonable to do a liquid biopsy, depending on how long it's going to take for your tissue testing to come back. At our institution, tissue testing comes back within 7 to 10 days, so a liquid biopsy takes around the same amount of time. The problem with the liquid biopsy is if it's positive, it's useful. If it's negative, it's not useful. And there are still some patients who will be positive in liquid and then negative on tissue, although not as commonly. And the idea is that the liquid can give you a better idea of the whole milieu of the tumor. So if he had something that was detected on liquid, it would be helpful. But if the liquid biopsy was negative, it may just be that the patient wasn't shedding enough circulating free DNA for that to be detected in the liquid biopsy.
Just kind of curious, though, kind of beyond the question of whether they're actionable mutations, can liquid biopsies inform about whether a tumor is a non-squamous or squamous, Leora?
So the liquid biopsy is not going to give you the napsin and the P40, but on the other hand, we wouldn't expect to see EGFR, ALK, ROS1 in a squamous cell patient unless they were a never smoker. So it could potentially help there. P53 is going to show up in both. BRAF or MET exon 14 can show up in both, so it depends on what mutation you end up detecting and whether or not it could help you or not.
You said BRAF and exon 14, you can see that in squamous?
You can. BRAF has been reported in squamous, and so have MET exon 14.
And they respond to targeted therapy?
The BRAF has been reported to respond. I don't know about the MET exon 14 skipping mutations.
Well, that's really interesting. Anyhow, so kind of getting back to the patient, so that's great. The patient had a response. What was the next step?
It's an interesting chain of events that happened at this point. He finished the frontline treatment. We were very happy. He was very happy. The disease on imaging has very limited disease left. So we, at the time, we decided to not do anything or do early second line treatment with pemetrexed or bevacizumab. So he went to MD Anderson, get a second opinion on this, had a nice visit, and they were screening him for some clinical trials, also offered a second look at his histology. I have all the original biopsy slides shipped over. So in this process, he came back. On the way there, he started to notice a slight balance issue also notice a left abdomen and left thigh numbness of the skin. He didn't mention it at the time because he was feeling great otherwise. So he did not mention those symptoms at his visit at MD Anderson. He came back, two things happened. MD Anderson reviewed original slides, felt like there was a weak stain on synaptophysin. The original pathologist looked at that, felt like it was a negative stain and treated as a non-small cell histology. But MD Anderson reviewed it, felt like actually that point them towards a poorly differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. So that's a slight change in the histology. Well, slight. It is a change in his histology. We were talking about what to do about this new information. Then second, at the end of the interview, he mentioned these complaints. And we did a physical exam. It definitely raised concern for CNS and spinal metastases. So we went ahead, had MR scan of his brain and MR scan of his spine. So at this time, we found out he had a small cerebellum metastases, and also he had a T3 cord metastases. So he still felt great. You know, his performance status was very good, other than these neurological complaints. So of course, that pushed all the other discussions about histology, about what to do next, into the back burner. So we went ahead, sent him to radiation oncology. And my experience with patients with cord metastases, that they don't do well, and it significantly impacts their prognosis. So we were pushing the agenda a little bit. So I actually offered him concurrent immune therapy. So we started him on nivolumab at the same time. And at this juncture, he was doing the radiation. And so he actually went to Sarah Cannon, had a third opinion on this situation, and taking into consideration of all the new findings of brain and core metastases. So at the moment, actually, he's being screened and ready to start a clinical trial at this point.
So what kind of clinical trial is he going to go on?
So on his foundation testing, he had three mutations. It seemed to fit this small molecule that was used in this trial that targeting all three mutations. And the investigator felt like it's a perfect fit. So he has not started trial yet. He's ready to have a restaging scan for trial purposes in the next 2-3 days.
So what's your working diagnosis at this point in terms of the histology, Yan?
Well, so that's one question, you know, I was trying to get a second opinion on today too. When I was treating him, I was thinking this is definitely the right histology for carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel, just because the wonderful response he got. And because the initial ambiguity histology, I sent it out for cancer ID on the biopsy sample, and that came back actually 90% confident is adenocarcinoma histology. And that came back about 2 cycles into treatment. My experience with cancer is not perfect testing, but between small cell neuroendocrine and adeno, they usually has been pretty good at distinguishing. So that boosts my confidence moving on. So felt like I'm pretty good. This is so I'm a little slightly confused actually, because I wasn't sure that this is a difference in opinion in pathologist, because the pathologist original did a biopsy, knew the synaptophysin stain. They look at it, they interpret it as a negative. So it wasn't a new stain obtained in MD Anderson. It was a different interpretation of the same slides.
So interesting.
So I'm puzzled. But to me, there are overlapping regimens between small cell and adeno. We can definitely pick some overlapping regimens in the future. But then, of course, the trial right now is inserted. So that changed our consideration a little bit.
So putting aside, Leora, this question of whether, you know, the target, that maybe this new target or novel agent, just kind of curious how often you run into a situation where you're not really clear about the histology, as in this one, and how would you approach management, at least moving forward based on the information that you see there, Leora?
Yeah, so it's not common, but it's not uncommon that you may have a patient just because there's a lot of crush artifact or there's necrotic tumor that you're not going to have a clear idea of histology, and carbo-nab-paclitaxel is a regimen that you could use both in squam and non-squam. So I think that that was a very reasonable treatment option to consider for him. He likely has a mixed histology tumor, given that he had such a rapid response to the platinum-based chemotherapy. And the fact that he had that response tells me that it probably wasn't just purely adeno. In terms of the treatment that he's on now, nivolumab is an option for second-line therapy for non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, for squamous non-small cell lung cancer as well. And then even though the CheckMate 331 data was negative, showing that nivolumab wasn't better than topotecan or emarubicin in the second line for small cell, if you look at the subset analysis from that study, it actually showed that there was potentially some benefit in patients with chemotherapy refractory disease. And he has chemotherapy refractory disease because he progressed almost immediately after completing his platinum-based chemotherapy. And so we were actually talking with the patient today saying, well, we don't even know if nivolumab has not worked. He's feeling well. He was just tired from the radiation, but he actually said for the last few days he's been feeling better. And so he definitely needs that restaging CT scan before he goes on any study to make sure that he's not responding to nivolumab, because if he is, then why would you waste his time? And technically, he probably wouldn't qualify for a clinical trial because he doesn't have progressive disease.
That's really interesting. So kind of looking down the line, Leora, if he does require another line of therapy, and unless he's going to have a spectacular response to nivolumab, it seems like that might be pretty likely. What would you be thinking about next, Leora?
I'd probably consider something like irinotecan, which is a small cell drug, but it's also a drug that you can use in non-small cell, even though NCCN has taken it out of the guidelines. I always like to use single-agent paclitaxel as a second-line option in small cell. I know that Jan was also talking about carboetoposide atezo, although I think that if he doesn't respond to nivo, he's not likely to respond to atezo either, but carbo and etoposide could be a reasonable option for someone who has small cell if he could tolerate more of a platinum agent. He was pretty young and robust despite everything that he's been going through.
Do you think he has small cell, Leora?
Probably. I mean, his scans seem like small cell, just kind of the location and the rapid progression of his disease and the fact that his tumor melted away so quickly with just two cycles of a platinum-based chemotherapy. I wouldn't expect to see that in a non-small cell patient. So he's probably got a mixed histology tumor is what I think he has. Because you also wouldn't expect this with a large cell neuroendocrine tumor. They don't respond nicely like this patient did.
I was just kind of reflecting about on your small cell study with the atezo, how you really didn't have much tissue to go on. That was one of the points that came out. I think you used liquid biopsies there because I guess there wasn't that much tissue.
Yeah, they had to have a confirmation of small cell and histology, but they didn't have to have enough tissue to do things like TMB.
Right.
Because you can't get it on those patients.
And also, I guess, PD-L1?
Correct, yeah. There was not enough tissue in the patients enrolled for PD-L1, so we did blood-based TMB.
So it was just TMB. You can't really do blood-based PD-L1.
There's some companies that are claiming that they can do that, so we'll have to see how well that comes out in the wash. It's hard to imagine how you can determine the staining with just a few circulating free DNA, but right now it's not ready for prime time for sure.
Just kind of curious a little bit about him as a person, Jan. What's his lifestyle like? Was anyone with him today in clinic?
Nobody was him. Today, I'm so surprised. He has a very, very supportive wife. They're a very outgoing, fun-loving couple and travels a lot. He's a very happy person and looking for positive feedbacks, you know. So when he get better, he will tell you he gets better. He want to hear you telling him how excited and how happy you are for him, and that reinforce him to feel even better. So at the beginning of the treatment, he was very depressed. And as he get response, the response itself actually made him feel more positive. He's a person I think definitely do better with positive outcomes. And I can see him get depressed easier if there is setbacks. Yeah.
You mentioned, Leora, that you kind of felt like a med student going around in clinic today. You're used to seeing your own patients. I'm kind of curious how it was like kind of looking over Jan's shoulders and seeing the same kind of patient you see, but from a different perspective. How did he come across to you as a patient in terms of how he's facing this situation, Leora?
He definitely trusts her. I think all of her patients do. They were full of compliments. I think he was probably the most reluctant to have me there. He was very clear, like, I've seen someone else, I have a plan, and wasn't as interested in what we talked about.
I think my take on that is I think he was presented with several options.
Yeah.
I think he struggled a little bit to get on trial or not. He finally made a decision. I don't think he's 100% sure, but he wants to be sure. He's afraid of you talking him out of it.
Got it. Okay.
So what? Yeah. Because I think Lara was wonderful to bring up that the importance of imaging. To me, that is a very good point for him. So when she first brought it up, he was a little scared, actually, thinking this is something she tried to talk him out of. We had to actually repeat it a couple of times to say how wonderful that would be. True psycho Nevo would have caused the effect. Why would he abandon something wonderful? Then he feed on the positive information. He felt a lot better.
The other thought I had just kind of listening to the two of you, relevant to your point, Lior, before we got started about the challenge of being in general medical oncology, I'm listening here, listening to Yan go through lung cancer, which she's obviously totally on top of, I think, in terms of literature. But I've done programs with her on breast cancer and a bunch of other tumors, and I can tell you she would be equally comfortable going through that. So it's just really amazing how people like Yan can actually keep up with all these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's hear about your third patient, this older lady. How old is she?
She is, let's see, she's 85 now. So when I saw her, she was 82. So it's a really sweet lady. And this is from one of my satellite clinics. I go an hour away from my main clinic one day a week. So she lives far away. So when we first saw her 2 years ago, February 2017, she was diagnosed stage 4 disease. It was adenocarcinoma. At her age, I would say her performance status is probably between 1 and 2 at the time. And so her PD-L1 at the time was 30%. So her disease was caught at the moment. Initially, there was no data for chemo combo with pembrolizumab. So I gave her single agent pemetrexed. And then we added pembrolizumab later on based on that PD-L1. And so she tolerated reasonably okay. My principle treating her is I want her to have as much quality of life as possible, not to make her too sick. So as we progress with treatment, she has a moderate response, but then she started to develop a little bit of more short of breath, especially exertion, a little bit more cough. It wasn't clear it's for sure immune therapy related pneumonitis, but at the time she was approaching finishing 6-cycle treatment. So we decided just to hold off. So we stopped treatment, just left alone for a while. And then I think she had a little bit of progression. So we decided to give her pembrolizumab alone. And then she had a little more cough, a little more worsening dyspnea exertion. We halted again in case this is any possible immune therapy related pneumonitis. And she was okay for a while. Then most recently, she had a little more aggressive progression, had an enlarging hilar lymph node, but nowhere else, just isolated. So the most recent development is we decided to do a little bit target radiation to that lymph node and just resumed immune therapy again in the last 6 weeks or so. She got 2 doses in right now.
So, Lior, I'm kind of curious what your impression was of her. How healthy of an 85-year-old did she appear to be? And what do you think about the course up to this point?
She was pretty frail. She said she was tough and she must be tough to have gone through so much therapy. She was there in clinic with her daughter today and she said at home she was doing some things but had to pause so she could make her bed, but then she had to sit down for a little bit. So I'm not sure if I'd seen her up front, if I might have just rode out the pemetrexed and stopped it when she got fatigued and then started pembrolizumab at the time of progression, although I don't think that there was any harm in combining. But then when patients get toxicities, and this is what's so hard about when you do the carboplatin pemetrexed pembrolizumab up front, when patients hit about 8 or 9 months of therapy, they're tired. And you've then worked them up. They don't have hypothyroidism. They don't have adrenal insufficiency. Are they benefiting from the pemetrexed, or if they're benefiting from the pembrolizumab, and which drug do you stop? And we more often will discontinue the pemetrexed and continue on with the pembrolizumab. She has an isolated area of recurrence, so I would have approached it the same. We're pretty aggressive in biopsying those people. I have diagnosed 1 metastatic colon cancer and 1 breast cancer in a patient who looked like they were progressing. I do try biopsy those folks, but I would have also gone for radiation in this patient for a single site of recurrence to see if we can continue to ride out the immunotherapy for a while.
I saw a paper you did, Lior, also on small cell in terms of progressing on a checkpoint inhibitor. Did I read that right?
Those were two patients who were KRAS mutant positive who were on IO. And when they progressed, one was biopsied for a study, and we found out that they had had a transformation to small cell. And the other patient came in with rapidly progressing disease, and when we did the thoracentesis, that patient had small cell. And so the hard thing that we don't know is those patients had been on a checkpoint inhibitor for more than a year. So had they developed a second tumor, or had they had true transformation of their tissue? And one of the patients, a KRAS mutation, was still present in the small cell specimen, suggesting potential transformation of the tissue.
That is really interesting. Lior, what was your take about the, I guess, shortness of breath or pneumonitis that she had?
Yeah, it's hard to know. You know, her SATs were pretty good, and she got better with a Medrol dose pack. So that tells me that if she did, it was a really grade one, or I guess grade two, because it was symptomatic pneumonitis. And so those patients, I would definitely re-challenge. We talked earlier, there's another patient who had a florid toxicity from a checkpoint inhibitor that you wouldn't want to re-challenge them. And if this patient had a drop in her oxygen saturations and had pneumonitis on imaging, I would not necessarily have re-challenged. The other part about that I think is harder in the community, and we were talking with some of Jan's colleagues, is when I send someone for a scan, I immediately get the results. I can look at their images. They have to rely on an outside group who is doing the images and to get those images quickly. So it's not as easy to get that quick CT scan in clinic as it is when you're in a big hospital with multiple scanners.
Jan, what would you be thinking in terms of future therapy for this patient? At what point would you consider hospice for this patient?
Well, so that's why about 2 years now for her since we started treatment. Her performance status right now is not any worse than when we started. So I'm pretty unhappy of that. I think, actually, the way I developed a relationship with this patient, I think she would be very outspoken in her mind when her performance status deteriorated and she feel like the treatment offering to her is not worthwhile for the, she will let me know. That's one way I figured out. I think if she progressed on immune therapy, I might consider single agent, something else to try. I mean, I think with her, she is where she was to begin with. I think I would try something. And I'm confident she will let me know if she feel like her quality of life would deteriorate and not worthwhile to continue treatment or anything.
Liora, any thoughts about her future therapies?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about docetaxel. And so I've never given full dose 75 of docetaxel outside of a study. So we talked a little bit about either weekly, like 36 milligrams per meter squared, 2 weeks on, 1 week off, or 60 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks. I probably wouldn't add ramucirumab in an 85-year-old because there are more toxicities with the combination. But single agent, I think it could be a good option for her if she has further progression.
How about in a younger patient in better condition? How do you think through the issue of adding ramucirumab, Liora?
I have to say I was a little bit of a naysayer when the data came out. But that's probably because the data came out as checkpoint inhibitors were entering the trials. But now when you're back to chemo IO upfront and you get to second line, I do quite a bit of docetaxel at 60 milligrams per meter squared, the Japanese dose, with ramucirumab in patients. And a lot of them do really well for quite a while.
Do you tend to use it more, Lior, in someone who's never had Bev, or does that not really enter into it?
I was never a big upfront Bev user after the pemetrexed data came out. So I used to do a lot of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab. But then when carbopemetrexed came along, it just was such an easier regimen to give. And because the carbopemetrexed Bev data was no better, I used to use carbopemetrexed on its own and just do maintenance PEM. So it didn't come up as often, although the data from that study would suggest that ramucirumab, because it targets VEGF in a slightly different manner, did have efficacy even in patients who'd had bevacizumab.
Can you talk a little bit about the data that supports the use of ramucirumab? I know, as you say, you know, we've been talking about checkpoint inhibitors so much the last couple of years. All those old discussions that we used to have a couple of years ago seem like a long time ago, but many of these patients, most of them, end up getting to that decision point. Can you talk about the data? In particular, one of the things that was interesting about those data was the fact that it looked at squamous as well as non-squamous.
Yeah, so that trial enrolled patients with squamous and non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer who had progressed on a platinum-based regimen, and they were given docetaxel at the 75 milligrams per meter squared with or without ramucirumab. And there was an improvement in response rate. So the response rate went up to, I think it was around 25% or 20% with combination therapy. And there was a 6-week improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival, which is why a lot of people sort of poo-pooed the data and said, well, you know, it's only 6 weeks, and so it's not such a significant benefit. But for patients, it is a tolerable regimen. It's safe in both squamous and non-squamous. And so it has been, I have adopted it as one of the treatment options that I've included in my patients. Interestingly, when a lot of the trials were out with the checkpoint inhibitors, KEYNOTE-010, the CheckMate trials, the Poplar and the Oak trials, those were not docetaxel and ramucirumab compared to the checkpoint inhibitors. It was just docetaxel. And that's because ramucirumab did not get approval in many parts of the world, including the EU, where they use more docetaxel and nintedanib than they do ramucirumab.
So, yeah, and I'm trying to remember whether you and I have done any programs on gastric cancer, HCC, where, you know, ramucirumab starting to come into HCC finally, but gastric cancer, I think, was really where things started out. What's your experience with ramucirumab in general, Yan, and are you using it in non-small cell?
I used in some patients and had a good experience with it. I think the ramucirumab does add, it's not like bevacizumab, and it does add a little more toxicity into the regimen. But usually, I mean, I had a pretty good tolerance in it, and we use it in GE junction and the gastric in a lot more as well. So I do, it's a drug I go to a lot.
Just kind of curiously, or I was surprised when I saw that they studied it in squamous. Backtracking on why Bev was sort of pushed out of squamous and why ramucirumab with a pretty similar mechanism is being utilized. Can you kind of talk about that?
So the phase one data with Bev actually came out of Vanderbilt, and Dave Johnson was leading a lot of that work, and he noted that there was a high incidence of death in patients with squamous cell histology who were treated with bevacizumab, a higher incidence of fatal hemoptysis, probably because the patients who got bevacizumab were maybe responding too well. Their tumors were melting away. And so for that reason, the phase three trial, ECOG-4599, allowed patients with non-squamous or patients who had predominantly non-squamous histology. So for patients with mixed tumor, it was allowed. When ramucirumab came along, they did not see the same safety signals in patients with squamous cell histology, which allowed it to be evaluated in that patient population. And maybe it is something unique to Bev, or maybe it's just too good in that disease, because when you look at some of the VEGF TKIs, most of them have been evaluated both in squamous and non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. In fact, the only TKI right now that is not allowing patients with squamous cell histology on study is with sitravatinib. The trial with Nivo and sitravatinib has only been in non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, but many of the other VEGF TKIs have allowed patients with both squamous and non-squamous to receive therapy.
So we're hearing more and more about anti-angiogenics, Leora, in combination with checkpoint therapy. There was a big renal cell paper that was just presented at ASCO GU, which was, I think it was pembro, axitinib. TKIs have been looked at, that kind of a strategy. You have Bev in lung cancer, atezo-Bev. I'm just kind of curious what you think about that idea. I don't know, is ramucirumab being looked at also with combined with checkpoint inhibitors?
So there is a trial that's looking at pembro and ramucirumab, and Roy Herbst had that initial data with pembro and ramucirumab in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. I think the data is interesting. I was recently at a meeting, and I sort of put up a sarcastic slide that I called it the obligatory synergy slide, where drug X increases T cell and causes immune death. I think you can rationalize almost any combination. I think the axitinib data with the IO is definitely exciting compared to what we saw with sunitinib alone in renal cell. And I think the sitravatinib data in IO failures has been interesting, where we're seeing responses with sitravatinib and nivolumab in patients who've progressed on other checkpoint inhibitors. And so I think it's still to be determined where it fits into the lung cancer patient treatment regimens. We have an IIT at Vanderbilt with nivolumab and vorolanib in non-small cell squamous and thymic. And for the non-small cell, we're including IO failures. And so there definitely is a hint of efficacy there. Whether or not we'll move it to the first line setting or which combination to give it with, I think, is something that is going to be sorted out in the next few years.
Really interesting. So let's hear about your next patient, Yan, this elderly man.
Yeah, so this is a 76-year-old gentleman. He's still working full-time. When I initially saw him about 3 years ago, he was at a curative stage 3 disease. He had a surgery. Then he had adjuvant chemoradiation. So he was in remission between June 2016 until about November 2017. That's when he developed pleural recurrence and stage 4 disease. So he quit smoking back in year 2000 after about 30 years. So when the disease recurred, we did biopsy, and he had a well-differentiated adenocarcinoma histology, did not have any unique mutations, and he had a very high PD-L1 expression. I think it was about 90%. So we were very excited to put him on the trial at the time as an ex-smoker, put him on nivolumab and ipi combination trial in January 2018. And I was telling him, oh, how great immune therapy are. We're hopeful you're going to be the lucky few. Patient had long-term responses. But he did not have any response despite the high PD-L1 expression level. Then he proceeded with second-line treatment with carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, started in June of 2018. And he mostly worked through the chemotherapy. He probably took a little bit of time off. He was definitely fatigued, but not to a level for him to stop working completely. And then we followed that with pemetrexed and bevacizumab maintenance. So during this time when he has stage 4 disease, we did send off Foundation 1 testing for his tumor biopsy, pleural biopsy sample. It came back, he did have a RET mutation, and that data for the LOXO-292 came out. So I did send him to Sarah Cannon for a clinical trial evaluation for the oral agent. And so at the time, he was having a good response to carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. In his mind, after hearing both sides of it, his decision is to stay with what has been working and not change course in the middle of it. So we continue therapy, and now he's on maintenance therapy.
So it's a really interesting case. A few questions I want to ask Leora. Backtracking to the beginning, Leora, this man got chemo radiation therapy, and most likely if he presented today, he would have had consolidation with durvalumab. Just kind of curious how you are thinking through the approach to patients who relapse after that kind of a strategy, as this man did, but he didn't have the durvalumab. Are you repeating checkpoint therapy at some point in these patients?
So I think it sort of depends on when they relapse. So if a patient, and I've had a few patients who've relapsed on durvalumab, and I just go to platinum-based chemotherapy, or if they have a driver, would treat them based on what their driver mutation is. I think if they're off durvalumab and they're 6 months later and they relapse, I would re-biopsy and potentially consider a combination checkpoint inhibitor with chemotherapy in those patients. But if they're progressing on one IO, another IO is not likely to make much of a difference. And I would have gone to a platinum-based regimen similar to what he had.
Any comments on the fact that, as Yan was pointing out, he had a high PD-L1 level but yet did not respond to checkpoint therapy, in this case combinations? I noticed that he had a low TMB when he had the Foundation 1 assay. Do you think that might be part of why he didn't respond? And also, does TMB stay the same, incidentally, during the patient's treatment course?
I think we're learning more about TMB and how it changes. But yeah, we were talking because he was MSI stable. Those patients don't tend to respond to checkpoint inhibitors, TMB low, although, as you know, the Nivo-Ipi data keeps evolving because first the original filing was with TMB high, and then when they gave more information to the EU that wanted the information on TMB low patients, those patients appear to be benefiting as well. I think it just proves that we don't know what the appropriate biomarker is. We're using surrogates with PD-L1 and TMB, and I'm still convinced someone's going to find a true marker that would suggest use this therapy or don't use this therapy in patients similar to KRAS and EGFR monoclonal antibodies in colon cancer. But the reality is checkpoint inhibitors only work in about, the response rate's 50%, but if you look at the long tail of the curve of trials like KEYNOTE-024, the numbers continue to decrease to where you get to around 30% of patients are long-term responders. And so it does work in some patients, but in the majority that it does not work.
So this man got ipi/nivo. Yen, any toxicity there?
No, he didn't. And he progressed quite significantly. So we came up, he didn't have it for long. I think he had it for about 2 months or so, maybe 3 months. So it wasn't a long, it wasn't a long treatment course, but he did not have any issues with it. No toxicities, no.
Interesting. Any comments about the new generation of RET inhibitors that it looks like this man's going to be eligible for at some point? Leora, there's a lot of excitement about it. If you know up front that the patient has that, will you actually use targeted therapy up front?
Yes. So I actually saw someone in clinic on Wednesday who came with her test that said she was RET positive, and she was showing me an immunotherapy trial that she was being offered somewhere else. And I said, we have LOXO-292, and that's what I would do, and that's what she's actually starting next week. Although I, you know, this patient was interesting. He was there and with his family, and he said he tried a clinical trial. It didn't work. He's on chemo. He said, it ain't broke. Don't fix it. And I agree with him. The TKI data has shown us in the EGFR and ALK patients that overall survival is not really impacted. And so whether you get your TKI first versus chemo first and switch around, we just know the quality of life is different on the TKI versus chemo. And so I would ride out his chemo the same way as he's doing. And maybe by the time he needs a TKI, there may be a better drug out there, or he can just get LOXO-292 through Dr. Ma's office and not have to go somewhere for a clinical trial.
I'm curious, this patient that you saw, Leora, what was the PD-L1 level?
Her PD-L1 was low. It was like 10%, or it was less than 20.
When you have patients with known targetable mutations like EGFR, ALK, the classic ones, where do you bring in checkpoint inhibitors in terms of metastatic disease, Leora? That's been a point of contention over the years. And where does RET fit in? Is RET now sort of part of that group?
I think that RET does fit in that group, that if you have a target, and we saw data at ASCO last year from the French data that looked at multiple different mutations showing lower PD-L1 responses in patients with driver mutations. So I think we have to add RET to that cohort of patients. So if a patient has EGFR, ALK, ROS1, MET, exon 14, NTRK, we can add RET. BRAF, I would give them their TKI upfront. At the time of progression, specifically for patients who are ALK positive, there are multiple ALK inhibitors. The problem with EGFR right now is we're using osimertinib upfront. They progress. All we're left is with chemo. And then at the time of progression for those patients on targeted therapies, for the EGFR patients, I do think about the IMpower 150, the carboplatinum, bevacizumab, atezo data. I think it's interesting. I'd like to see more data with the true randomized studies that are ongoing. But a checkpoint inhibitor is reasonable to consider. I think an important thing to remember, though, is that if you give the checkpoint inhibitor and you want to go back to targeted therapy, you may cause more harm to the patients. Memorial just had that retrospective review of patients who got checkpoint inhibitors and then went on to osimertinib, and 15% of those patients got immune-related toxicities. Many of them had to be hospitalized to treat their toxicities. So even though you stopped the checkpoint inhibitor, the drug is still in the patients. It has made changes to the patient's immune system. And so we can see toxicities impacting further lines of therapy, even though the drug has been discontinued. Whereas they didn't see that issue when osimertinib was given first, and then a patient got a checkpoint inhibitor.
Wow, that was really interesting. I didn't know about that. So somehow the osimertinib is in some way interacting with the immune therapy?
Yeah, so, and we saw that with the Tatin and the Coral trial that closed early. There were higher incidence of pneumonitis in patients on combination. And we've seen Doug Johnson from Vanderbilt published several years ago in patients who got BRAF inhibitors having horrible skin toxicities when they got them after receiving a PD-1 inhibitor. So even though that drug has stopped, that drug has not stopped its effect on the patient that was receiving it.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, I'm hearing more and more people talk about that Empower regimen on relapse with the osimertinib patients. Yan, was this man a smoker or is he a smoker?
He was a 30-pack year smoker and quit in year 2000. So that's why I felt like he had a decent chance of responding to immune therapy, you know, as an ex-smoker. But I guess he quit for 17 years at a time once he started it.
I was just trying to think. I know EGFR and ALK, typically non-smokers, not always, but typically. But Leora, you know, hear about BRAF. I hear more about smokers. What about RET? Do you see smokers with RET?
You can see smokers with EGFR and ALK as well.
Sure.
So normally you would have an ever smoker, more commonly with RET, but you do see patients. And in November 2017, the Loxo drug wasn't really around. So
right.
Then all you were thinking, well, you could give vandetanib for a 40% response rate or nivo-ipi. So nivo-ipi in a high PD-L1 in 2017, it's amazing how the treatments are evolving and things are coming out fast and furious.
Oh, yeah, for
in
sure.
Terms of what we do.
Right. My understanding is that BRAF is, you see pretty commonly with smokers. Is that your take?
Correct, yeah. BRAF is something that we'll see in the smoking patient population.
Right. Any other questions or points about this man, Yan?
Just a small question. You know, he, at the time we struggled a little bit, he got carboplatin pemetrexed in his adjuvant setting. About a year and a half later, he recurred. We chose to reuse pemetrexed. I just wonder, Leora's input on that. What's your thought on that?
It's a good question. I mean, he had had intervening therapy with the nivo-ipi, mm-hmm. So don't know if that's driving some of the response that you're seeing, even though he progressed on the nivo-ipi.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, he was more than a year out, so I mm-hmm. don't think it would be unreasonable. If he had recurred within 6 months, I would have mm-hmm. definitely gone to a different regimen, but clearly, you chose the right thing because it's working.
Yeah, so retrospective, at the time we talk about it, we had it before in the year and a half long enough. So he felt he wanted to go with a safe run. He had it before. He had a really good time with it.
Yeah,
not
he knew
a big
what
deal,
to expect.
So he was a lot more comfortable with using that. I think just coming off failing the immune therapy, he wants something more sure. So I think that's what we decided to do.
So let's go on and hear about your 63-year-old lady.
Oh, yeah. So this has been quite a long journey with her. So we started this about, not quite four, 3.5 years ago. So at the time, she was 63 years old, and initial diagnosis was stage 4 disease. So she had disease involving mediastinum. She also had 3 small brain metastases at the time. So we debated of how aggressive we approach her initially. So even though she has 3 brain mets, we still went ahead, had SRS to the brain mets, then had a concurrent chemo radiation for her local regional disease in the chest. Later on, so I think about a year later, she had a progression, bone progression. We did a re-biopsy of that bone lesion. The time PD-L1 was 0. So despite being that, because she had only, at the time, she only had that bone lesion. So PD-L1 was 0, and we were trying to decide something maybe gentle and not as aggressive. So with immune therapy, that we actually did give her immune therapy. We gave her pembrolizumab, single agent, at that time just to see how she's going to respond, because really she has no other sites of disease. So she got 2 doses, then she developed profound fatigue. And I was in the workup to figure out why she's so tired. You know, her thyroid function was fine, cortisol level was fine, sugar was fine. Then we did an echocardiogram. Her ejection fraction came back about 20%. So we decided she had immune therapy-related cardiomyopathy, so we aborted immune therapy, gave her high-dose steroid, reversed that.
Before you go on, can we just backtrack into a few of these points? It's a really interesting case. So first I want to ask you, Lior, what you think about the initial management using chemoradiation in the face of brain mets?
Yeah, so, you know, we saw 2 different patients today who presented with sort of lung mass, mediastinal node, and this patient had 3 brain mets, the other patient had 1 brain met. And the definition of oligometastatic disease continues to expand. And so for this patient, it was reasonable to do stereotactic radiation to those 3 brain mets and then try to do concurrent chemo radiation back in 2015. We didn't have as many options for these patients. Now, if we saw this patient with three brain mets, we might have done stereotactic radiation and then done something like carbapemetrexed pembro, because in 2019, you have slightly different therapeutic options for those patients. But the treatment of localized or oligometastatic disease, it was very reasonable to do SRS and concurrent chemoradiation and observe the patient. And clearly she did well for 18 or 17 months after that treatment approach.
So the other question obviously here is the cardiomyopathy. I saw you were on a paper in the JAMA, I think it was JAMA Oncology or JAMA, about lethal side effects or autoimmune problems that have been observed, obviously very, very uncommon. Unfortunately, this lady's weren't, but certainly cardiomyopathy was on that list of potentially catastrophic problems. Can you talk about what we know, Leora, about cardiomyopathy related to checkpoint inhibitors and how you make the diagnosis? Do you think that's what happened here?
So it's a great question. It definitely sounds like it's what happened, given that she responded to steroids and her ejection fraction improved on therapy. Javed Moslehi with Doug Johnson and a group of collaborators at Vanderbilt actually were the first to describe it in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago. We don't know all of the causes of the cardiomyopathy, and unfortunately the patients that they initially described had fatal cardiomyopathy and died as a result. And so we had biopsies on those patients and found that their had no cancer and their hearts were just full of T cells.
Wow.
And so what that has led to at our institution is a lot of these patients automatically get troponins and EKGs with their therapy so that we can potentially catch it early. It was a great catch by Dr. Ma, because the first thing you think about with fatigue is their adrenal and thyroid function. And then you kind of think, well, their cancer, they're having symptoms from their cancer. There's so many grants and different agencies that are trying to define how best to predict which patients will develop these autoimmune toxicities. What's interesting is there's also data that some of these patients who develop autoimmune toxicities actually have better outcomes. So it's kind of how do you reconcile the two of, yeah, let's give you a bad side effect, but that just means that you're going to live longer and hopefully it's a side effect you can live with.
Just want to pick up on that last point because I've been asking that question ever since I first heard about checkpoint inhibitors, and there's been a lot of debate and controversy. Where are we today? Because when you made that statement, it sounds like maybe we have more definitive data on this question of correlation of autoimmune toxicity and benefit.
Most of it's still retrospective reviews. So most of it is still case series that we're seeing coming out. And what's interesting is depending on the disease, it can actually determine. So in GI tumors, recently there was data presented that maybe in GI tumors, the patients who get arthralgias have better outcomes with autoimmune therapy, whereas in other disease types, the patients who get rash with pembrolizumab, maybe they'll have a better outcome with their immune checkpoint inhibitors. I don't think we know enough to definitively say who develops what.
I'm kind of curious, Yan, when you say she had fatigue, did she also have any symptoms or signs of heart failure?
She did not have lower extremity edema, and she, as far as I can remember, she did not have significant dyspnea exertion. I mean, she's tired. I mean, it's hard to tell. Nothing dramatic, but just profoundly fatigued at the time.
Really interesting. So what happened next, and what's her current situation?
There are two tracks for her. So after that, when we move on to third-line treatment, we give her carboplatin and the nab-paclitaxel. Starting in April 2017, she had a good response, and then she had severe allergic reaction to carbo in that unusual development in the middle. So we aborted carbo. She has been on single agent nab-paclitaxel since that time. So one of the reasons I was asking Lyra about this is she has been on single agent, well, combo and then single agent treatment on this line for about a year, actually longer than a year now. So that's unusual to me to have not progressed at this point. So my question was, could be she's actually riding out immune therapy effect, even though she got only two doses of pembro. You know, a lot of these benefits she's enjoying was completely controlled. Systemic disease outside her brain is coming from pembro. Maybe I should stop her nab-paclitaxel because she's starting to have neuropathies affecting her quality of life. That's one part of her disease. The other part is separated is her CNS disease. She has three mets at the beginning. You know, I know immune therapy does not have as consistent a response in the CNS. So her CNS disease has been slowly progressing. We have been getting away with about every 4 to 6 months, she will have a new met that's slowly enlarging above a centimeter. We'll do SRS again. She had at least 3 more SRS treatment. Actually, during the clinic visit today, on her brain MRI, she has 1 more lesion that's going to be treated with SRS. So these 2 separate parts of her disease seem to be falling 2 separate courses.
So, Leora, first, any thoughts about what's going on here and the possibility that somehow there's a delayed benefit from the immune therapy and also kind of where you see things heading with these brain mets?
So, yeah, it's hard to know. She's been on nab-paclitaxel for almost 2 years. And so we were talking about, I have a couple of patients and one that came to mind in clinic who got nivolumab in the second line, and at about 6 months looks like she was progressing. So I gave her docetaxel, and after about 8 or 9 months, she said, I'm tired of docetaxel. I have neuropathy and I just want a break. And she's been on a break now for 18 months.
Wow.
And she's had no progression. And I think that she probably was responding to the checkpoint inhibitor or had pseudo progression, although we don't use that a lot. And maybe she never needed to get the docetaxel. And this is a little harder because everything below the CNS is controlled. And Sarah Goldberg's data and some of the other series that have come out with the CNS suggest that the response in the CNS is pretty similar to what you see systemically. Sarah had that study in patients with untreated brain mets who got Pembro and showing around a 30% response, which is what she was seeing systemically in those patients. What's interesting about this patient is that she doesn't have new brain mets. From what I understand, it's brain mets that have been present and they're growing. And so is it because the checkpoint inhibitor did work from below? And so we even talked to this patient that the nab-paclitaxel is not going to stop further progression in her brain. And that she asked Jan if she could get a checkpoint inhibitor again, and she said, absolutely not. We don't want to be doing CPR on you because of what happened. You had a severe toxicity. But if she held her nab-paclitaxel, she may continue to have occasional CNS progression, but continue to maintain her systemic response, and that observation would not be unreasonable because neuropathy, again, becomes that quality of life issue.
Wow, really interesting. Any other questions about this case, Jan, or any other points you want to make?
So another thing is, you know, her PD-L1 was 0. It's very, you know, at the time, because she had only 1 lesion, that's why we felt like, of course, I thought it would be a lighter treatment, gave her heart failure. But so that's why we did not want to, I thought it was a good thing to use immune therapy because we do think immune therapy can work slow and she got plenty of time to wait. So, I mean, Liara, in your practice, patient with 0% PD-L1, I guess they still could potentially respond.
Yeah, and we saw that. So it's interesting that you were able to get pembrolizumab because in the FDA label, they've got to be greater than 1% to get the drug. But the trials with atezolizumab and nivolumab enrolled patients regardless of PD-L1 score. And what we saw was that it depended. So for example, in the CheckMate 017 study in the squamous patients, PD-L1 didn't appear to predict for a response. Whereas in the CheckMate 057 with the non-squamous, you saw incremental increase in response in the patients who are PD-L1 greater than 1%. But we did see responses, although they were lower in the PD-L1 0%. And I think it just points to that imperfect biomarker. You know, if you're 0, you've got a 10% chance of responding. If you're greater than 1%, you've got a 30% response, right? Very different from the RET patient if they're 0% response versus a 70% response. So it's just not a great discriminator. And so I still would use a single agent checkpoint inhibitor. It's changed a little now, right? Because upfront from KEYNOTE 189 and 407, we're giving platinum pick your doublet with Pembro in the less than 50% patients. So that includes the 0% patients. Although in 189, there was no PFS benefit in those patients. So I don't think we really know what to do while this biomarker continues to plague everybody.
Let's hear about your next patient, the 71-year-old man.
So this is a gentleman who first saw me with actually considered a curative stage disease, stage 3A. At the time, he had the T4 7.1 centimeter tumor, got resected, a tumor actually abutting 2 lobes. And he interestingly had 0 out of 19 nodes resected. There was no nodal involvement at the time. So he just had a lot of fear of chemo and was very frail. had existing lung disease, breathing was borderline. He himself, he admitted later on, was dragging his feet. He did not want to start adjuvant treatment. So he saw me, and by the time he saw me, in everything was diagnosed in June, and by the time eventually he made it back to clinic to proceed with adjuvant treatment, it was almost 4 months later. So I said, well, we've got to have to do a restaging scan. It's too far out. We need to make sure the cancer is still under control. When we did that scan, of course, at this point, he has stage 4 disease. He now has multiple lung metastases, pleural metastases, and it was not curative. So at this point, we decided to put him on carboplatin, nab-paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab. So his performance status was 2, maybe extra little more at the time because of his breathing status and everything. So actually I gave him carbo nab-paclitaxel on a weekly basis. I don't think he would have tolerated a larger dose. And he actually slowly improved. His performance status now is close to 1 now. His breathing's a lot better, still not perfect. You know, most recently what happened was he developed a carboplatin allergic reaction during treatment, pretty severe. So we aborted it. So he's now just on single agent nab-paclitaxel with pembrolizumab. So my question for Lyra was, in my mind, so he has not gotten platinum in the last 2 cycles of treatment. So should I just move on to pembrolizumab maintenance, or should I consider adding nab-paclitaxel to the maintenance, or would she have replaced, I did not continue platinum, would she have used cisplatin in the case with carboplatin allergy, so that patient would have a platinum doublet in his regimen?
So those are all really awesome questions, Lyra. How do you answer them?
So I probably would not have replaced the cisplatin with the carboplatin, especially in a patient who had a poor performance status. And we can't guarantee that he's not going to have the same reaction to cisplatin that he had with the carboplatin. As far as the nab-paclitaxel maintenance, there was recently a study that looked at that of carbo-nab-paclitaxel compared to carbo-nab-paclitaxel maintenance with nab-paclitaxel in patients with squamous cell histology, and the data was negative. So I would have done just 4 cycles of the platinum doublet with the nab-paclitaxel with the pembro, and then dropped the chemotherapy and continued with maintenance pembrolizumab alone. We were talking about 4 versus 6 cycles, and I don't think that there's a right or wrong answer there. Most of the studies did 4 cycles. I know that there are a lot of oncologists who have a preference to do 6 cycles of the platinum doublet. And I think with him, this was going to be his last cycle with chemo pembro before he got his restaging scans, and he continues on pembrolizumab maintenance therapy.
And he had a weekly dose.
Yeah.
He initially only did 2 weeks on, 1 week off because he was so weak. Then eventually we did 3 weeks on. So he's not a standard dosing for him.
I actually never do the nab-paclitaxel. We abandoned day 15 a while back. So we actually, the regimen we have at our institution is the full dose carbo day 1 with the nab-paclitaxel. A week later, nab-paclitaxel, and then a week off. And so we have adopted that 3-week regimen, which more fits with what you, with the pembrolizumab scheduling, because the pembro is every 3 weeks, as it was in KEYNOTE-407.
So any other comments about this case? Again, maybe just to go back to a similar question I asked you before, how do you find interacting with him as a person, Yan, and his family?
Oh, you know, I think the biggest interaction with him initially is persuade him to consider a little bit of treatment. I think actually when he, you know, he had a lot of hesitation initially when he came back with stage 4 disease, he was ready just to quit. So that's why we started in a such a gentle fashion for him, because we had a long back and forth, several discussions. He needed a long time to think. He really said, do you think, you know, I can tolerate, should I just go on hospice? And so that was the back and forth discussion. So we decided to do a weekly dose, and I told him I really don't think he will have dramatic toxicity to a weekly dose, and he can have a taste of what chemo like. And then I find that a lot of time patients can get rid of their fear just in general of chemotherapy by starting with a low dose like that, especially palliative patients.
I'm going to ask Lyra in a second about the issue of early palliative care that's been studied in lung cancer, but I'm just kind of curious, in your situation, Yan, do you have access to a palliative care team? Not now, I'm not talking about hospice, but palliative care team.
We do. That's a recent change incorporated, I think, in our practice. Now we have a palliative care nurse in our clinic.
Really?
And that's, it started about a year ago, and she's there one day a week. Now it's going to be expanded to 3 days a week. So it's a nurse practitioner that sees all the patients for our location, and it's going to be expanded to practice-wide. So all the practice location eventually will have a palliative care nurse, yeah.
So did this man see that nurse practitioner?
That at the time, I did not refer him because I feel like it's my response. At the time, I don't think his a palliative care issue is more of goal of treatment. I mean, I don't think it's wrong for him to be decided. I always tell patients it's his life, his quality life. It's his decision to make. So I don't think it would be wrong for him to not get any treatment because I'm not offering a cure per se. But my feeling always is he had this fear, why not try and see how the treatment going to be? Then he can make his decision. So he right now, he got much better now. At this second, actually, he has not been seeing a palliative care nurse at this time.
I'm kind of curious what your take is on this, Leora, because a lot of people sort of equate palliative care to hospice care. And yet, if you really look into what they looked at in the study, the initial study by Jennifer Temel, these patients were seeing them at diagnosis. So they weren't end of life by any means. They felt like there was a benefit that kind of went beyond end of life type issues in terms of, I guess, clinical management of the patient. I'm curious, Leora, what your take is on this.
I think it can be very helpful. So we also have palliative care available at our clinic. I think the biggest issue for the patients is convenience. And so initially when palliative care was implemented, they were also only there a couple days a week. And patients didn't necessarily want to come back and make another visit. And something a patient brought to my attention, which I didn't really think about, is they have multiple copays then. Mm. So they have to have their $30 copay for me and then their $30 copay for palliative care. And maybe they're seeing radiation oncology. So they've spent $100 seeing three different doctors that day, which can really have its impact on a patient and their livelihood, especially for many of these patients. They're elderly, they're on fixed incomes. But I do think that it does have that benefit. Obviously, the Temel study showed us that there was an improvement in survival with palliative care. The palliative care folks are better, I think, than oncologists. They have longer clinic visits with the patients. They block off more time. They spend more time sometimes talking to the patients. So we have a lot of patients who are followed by palliative care. And in fact, we're participating in the follow-up study that Dr. Temel is doing right now, looking at telemedicine and patients in palliative care. So we have a bunch of patients who are enrolled on her study that is evaluating how that can impact palliative care delivery to cancer patients.
Wow, telemedicine for palliative care. I like that a lot. That sounds great. Really interesting. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and to our community-based general medical oncologist. And thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Visiting Professors.